Hello, this is Zalman, and this is my third episode on my podcast. This episode is called The Famed Memento. Now, this episode is dedicated to the one and only person that I picked during our family Hanukkah grab bag this year. Now, as you may have noticed, that only one person in my family has a very famed and honored wedding memento, and his name is Dovi. Now, Dovi has implored of me multiple times to make podcast episodes dedicated to reading his Tshura. Honestly, I agree with him. Like, his Tshura should not be limited to the 900 or so copies given out, but rather should be on the worldwide internet, free forever. Now, I did say it's free, but there's a link in the description that you can donate to, and most of that money will go to recording and enhancing real Geshmake Chazonos, which obviously would go straight on Spotify, and you will be able to enjoy it. So feel free to donate. Either way, originally when I picked him out, I was wondering like what I should get him besides to request the gift, and I'm like, I would love to read his Tshura, but I need a good reason to, like to read it on my podcast, and here's a great reason. So here I am reading it, and I will be making a full season dedicated to reading his Tshura. Now, honestly, I'm not really sure what season means, like on Spotify podcasts, like, I don't know, but it's on my anchor page, so let's go. And yeah, so I'll be starting off by reading from the beginning, which is obviously my favorite part, because it's about my namesake, Harav Reb Zalman Bronstein. And yeah, so first of all, he obviously has the same name as me, and he has a Spotify page under Reb Zalman Bronstein, REBZALMANBRONSTEIN, where you can listen to his Spotify, to his music, his beautiful chazanis, and listen, enjoy, follow, subscribe, everything. And yeah, and also his the parts about him in the Tshura are honestly very inspirational. Not like from Rangan inspirational, because that's like eh, but like actually action-inducing. So therefore, I'll be starting off with the first section, which is called Soldiering On, The Life of Reb Zalman Bronstein. And in that section, I'll be starting off with the first chapter called Secret Mission. This is the first chapter of Secret Mission. The 1920s were a dangerous time under the new leadership that took hold in the Soviet Union. Communist forces were undermining Jewish life, and synagogues and schools were shuttered in rapid succession. Jewish leaders were imprisoned, exiled, or murdered, and Jewish activists were on high alert, terrified of the brutal acts carried out by the communist regime daily. Zalman Bronstein felt this fear in the ear he read. Silence was imperative for survival, and his father, Chaim Ezra, guarded his activities closely by concealing the details of his involvement. Chaim Ezra Bronstein had studied in the famed Tanchumit Tumim Yeshiva in the town of Lubavitch, training to become an expert scribe and ritual circumciser. By 1926, however, circumcisions were attended by a mere few. Thus, when Chaim Ezra asked his son Zalman to be sanded at a bris, Zalman was surprised by an unexpected initiation into his father's world. Silently, the duo arrived at a large villa, an anomaly in Hummel. It held countless luxurious rooms, winding staircases, and marble floors. Zalman understood that this was the home of a high-ranking communist official. While Chaim Ezra walked confidently, Zalman's heart pounded with every step. An elderly woman entered the room clutching a small infant. Zalman did as his father instructed, sitting down in one of the ornate chairs and taking the eight-day-old child in his arms. Chaim Ezra quickly performed the bris, bandaged the child, and gave him a Jewish name and handed the child back to the elderly woman. They returned home. They did not exchange a word about what had taken place, and Zalman never uncovered the backstory to that particular circumcision, where father and mother were not present. Thus, Zalman was raised with the ethos of doing everything to uphold Jewish life, and his father Chaim Ezra and mother Shana Gisa imbued this quality in him, seldom with words, but rather with action. Move on to the next chapter called Righteous Roots. The Bronstein family had deep roots in Lubavitch. Zalman's grandfather, Zev Volk Bronstein, was known for being soft-spoken, cautious, and quiet, spending hours in prayer daily. It was rumored that during many years he spent in Lubavitch, he slept and ate little, causing his teeth to fall out. He was said to be a Beinoni, a lofty standing requiring devotion to God and complete control over one's thoughts and actions. Some referred to him as an angel on account of his conduct. To support his family, he worked as a guard for Shmuel Gerari, who owned a forest, while spending most of his time studying Torah. At one point, he began to produce alcoholic beverage drinks to sell on the black market, risking immediate arrest. Once, while deep in prayer, the authorities came to his home and found the bottles of alcohol he was producing. Before leaving, they sealed the door to the home distillery, saying they would return soon to press charges. All the while, Zev Volk remained in prayer. When he finally removed his prayer shawl, his daughter Bloomer frantically asked him what they should do. He calmly told her, "Now we will break the seal." He returned to his prayers, and quite mysteriously, the police never returned. Zev Volk once asked the Rebbe Rasha for a blessing that he merit a Jewish burial, a strange request for that time. Years later, in the early 1940s, when the Lubavitch Cemetery is plowed and replaced with high-rise buildings, they moved the body of the Rebbe Rashab and the Grawry brothers. Zev Wolf's remains were moved as well, near the Rebbe Shab's plot, prompting his family to recall his request for a Jewish burial. We will talk about Ezra the scribe. Solomon's father, Chaim Ezra, exemplified the tenets of Hasidic life. When the yeshiva's founder, the Rebbe Rashab, encouraged students to become scribes, Chaim Ezra was the first to accept the challenge. He was not only meticulous in his art form, but also in his spiritual preparation for the task. It was said that when possible, each time he wrote God's name, he would first immerse in the mikvah. Once, when Chaim Ezra was visiting the Rebbe Rashab, the Rebbe told businessman Shmuel Grari that Chaim Ezra is in town and recommended that Shmuel have his phone checked by him. Later, he was referred to by the Rebbe Yatz as Ezra the scribe, drawing a comparison to the righteous biblical character by the same name. Once, at a forbringing for the Rebbe Yatz, after several rounds of L'chaim, Ezra found himself asleep under the table. The Rebbe said to those gathered, "A sefer," referring to the word sefer, scribe, as well as a sefer, a holy book, is under the table and no one's lifting him up. Chaim Ezra's connection to the Rashab was profound. When he received a telegram informing him of the Rebbe's passing, he fainted. Chaim Ezra was also known for allowing others to use his address for communication with the Rebbe Rayatz. This was no simple favor as it placed him in full sight of authorities. For Chaim Ezra, however, the Rebbe took precedence. It is also believed that the Lubavitch Rebbes had their tefillin written by him. The son-in-law of the Rayatz, Ramash, later the Rebbe, ordered a specific kind of leather for his tefillin, known as ben pikua, that was difficult to come by at a time when people lacked survival basics. It is notable that the Ramash apportioned a significant amount of money for his tefillin. When the Ramash was later asked why he chose Chaim Ezra to write his tefillin, he responded that while there may have been other scribes with nicer writing, Chaim Ezra is a truly God-fearing Jew. Now we will move on to the next chapter called Torah on the Run. Born in Cherkasy, Ukraine, Zalman Bronson and his siblings, Michal, Etty, and Bluma, never joined the compulsory government schools where atheism and disdain for religion was inculcated. This was made possible by a bribe to the doorman who served as eyes and ears for the communists in the building, so that he would not report that the Bronstein children were truants. Zalman went to a cheder, an ad hoc Jewish school, where he studied with several other children. In addition to cheder, Chaim Ezra wanted his children to study the Nach portion of the Torah. At that time, Nach was widely adopted by the Zionist movement, and it took some time for Chaim Ezra to find a suitable teacher for his children. Eventually, the communists found out that Chaim Ezra's children were not attending a government school, and they began to harass him. Despite the danger, Chaim Ezra refused to capitulate. In 1920, Chaim Ezra told Zalman, 11, and his brother Michal, who was 9, that they were to continue their studies in the clandestine yeshiva in Kremenchuk, which meant that they would be leaving home. They traveled some 80 miles, including a boat ride over the Dnieper River, before arriving at the yeshiva. It was housed in a decrypt space, which they later abandoned after authorities discovered its location. While delivering his children to the yeshiva, Chaim Ezra met fellow classmates from Lubavitch, including rabbis Yisrael Nayach Balanitzi and Cheskel Himmelstein. The joy Zalman witnessed at this reunion was etched into his memory for decades. Even the poverty in his own home could not prepare Zalman for yeshiva. They slept on benches in the women's sections of a local shul, while rats scurried around them all night. The students would eat at the homes of local families, but at times they had nothing to serve the hungry students. The self-sacrifice of his teachers taught him the price of studying Torah and practicing Judaism under communist rule. Rabbi Himmelstein, a thin, short man, was often ill and struggled with swallowing solid food. One Shabbos, Zalman went to his home for a meal and watched as Rabbi Himmelstein struggled to eat challah, but just couldn't. He survived on bites of chocolate that would melt in his mouth. Someone once asked Rabbi Himmelstein's doctor how his patient manages to stay alive on such meager sustenance. The doctor responded, "His enjoyment in studying Torah sustains him." Zalman recalled that every surface in Rabbi Himmelstein's room was covered in volumes of commentaries on the Gemara. As a lecturer, he would connect the basic texts with numerous commentaries in a seamless fashion. Despite being weak, Zalman recalled, his voice boomed when he taught us. After several years, in 1926, authorities shuttered the yeshiva. The students were eager to continue their studies, so the school split into two. One group joined the yeshiva in Polotsk, including Zalman's brother, and Zalman joined the other group at the yeshiva in Neville. There were 15 students who studied in the women's section of the shul in Neville. Their teachers were in acute danger, and the students feared for them daily. When an armed man appeared in the doorway of the shul one day, with a mere few glances, the students formulated a plan. Quickly, the students jumped on the man, wresting the gun from his hands. The teacher escaped in those precious few moments. When they let go of the officer, he ran for his life, fuming at the group and swearing swift retribution. It is unknown whether he returned because they quickly packed up their makeshift study hall and moved on to another location. Now we are moving on to the Rebbe's release. While most of the young students never met the Rebbe Rayatz, they had heard much about him. His love and care for their material and spiritual needs was part of their reality. In 1927, when they heard the Rebbe was arrested, Zalman recalled their deep distress and fear for the Rebbe's future. When the rebel was freed a few months later, Zalman said there was such joy. Ah, what joy. After yeshiva, because of the surrounding danger, the students celebrated by singing and dancing in a way the neighbors could not hear. A few months later, word arrived that the rebel was leaving the Soviet Union, but would first spend a month, the month of Tishrei, in Leningrad. Despite the danger, many Hasidim planned on spending at least some of the festive month with the rebbe. Fearing the worst, the yeshiva asked the students not to go, but Zalman could not pass up on the opportunity. It was a month of spiritual light, Zalman would say. He recalled the rebbe's voice reciting the blessing of the Torah. It was heavenly, such sweetness. I dream of hearing that blessing as it was recited then once again. A forbringen was held one day, but by the time Zalman arrived, there was no room for him. He saw a large heater hanging from the ceiling with a narrow space above it. When several people saw him climbing up, they began to yell that the oven could fall on their heads. The rebbe heard the commotion, looked up at Zalman, and said, "Let him, let him." Thus, Zalman spent the forbringen wedged in a nook above the crowd. While Zalman was away in yeshiva, his family moved to Nikolaev, Ukraine. Some 8 days after Zalman arrived in Leningrad, his father joined him, followed by his brother Michal, who had come from yeshiva in Plotsk. They had made their tremendous effort to come to the Rebbe, perhaps for the last time. Chaim Ezer was considering yet another move, this time to Malachovka. I can't pronounce that, but Malachovka, whatever. Either way, a small suburb of Moscow, where there was a large Lubavitch presence far from the city, where the secret police posed greater risk. He wanted the Rebbe's approval before making a final decision, so he asked to be received for a private audience. His request was denied because the Rebbe, with rare exception, was not holding private meetings. Chaim Ezra told his sons that he would visit the Rebbe's in Sterna Sara, the Rebbe's mother, whom he knew from his days as a student in Lubavitch, in hope that she would arrange an audience for Chaim Ezra with the Rebbe. Rebbe's in Sterna Sara was often referred to as the mother of the yeshiva, and she in turn would refer to the students as her children. When Chaim Ezra entered her home accompanied by his sons, she asked, "And these are the grandchildren?" With a wide smile, she blessed them. After a short discussion, the Rebbe's agreed to arrange an audience with the Rebbe for the three of them. When they entered the Rebbe's study, he greeted them, and echoing his mother, and asked, "These are the grandchildren?" The Rebbe gave them a blessing, which Zalman later said helped him in good stead for the next difficult 15 years in the Soviet Union. After a year in Neville, Zalman went to learn in Vitebsk, when the communists discovered the yeshiva was closed before anyone could be arrested. Together with the rest of the students, he went to a yeshiva in another city, always one step ahead of the communist regime. They continued moving from city to city for the next 2 years. Okay, that's it for today. Hope you enjoyed. I've been listening to it, and I really don't think I have the most podcaster voice, but that's what I got. Please share, send around, obviously follow and subscribe. And yeah, please look in the description, read a little, and maybe download the actual Shura and read it yourself. The link will be in the description, and hope you enjoy. Please send it out, and yeah, bye-bye. Have a great rest of your day.